Chapter 9 of A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception by Rudolf Steiner. Chapter 9 is entitled Thought and Consciousness. It appears, however, as if we ourselves had here introduced the very subjective element we were so determined to exclude from our theory of knowledge. Although the rest of the perceptual world does not possess a subjective character, so it might be deduced from our explanation, yet thoughts, even according to our own opinion, do bear such a character. This objection rests upon a confusion of two things: the theater in which our thoughts play their role, and that element from which they derive the determination of their content, the inner law of their nature. We do not at all produce a thought content in such fashion that in this production we determine into what interconnections our thoughts shall enter. We merely provide the occasion through which the thought content unfolds according to its own nature. We grasp thought A and thought B and give them the opportunity to enter into connection according to a principle. Let me read that again. We grasp thought A and thought B, and give them the opportunity to enter into a connection according to principle by bringing them into mutual interaction one with the other. It is not our subjective organization which determines this interrelation between A and B in a certain manner, but the content of A and B is the sole determinant. The fact that A is related to B in a certain manner and not in another, upon this fact we have not the slightest influence. Our mind brings about the interconnection between thought masses only according to the measure of their own content. Thus we fulfill the principle of experience in its very baldest form in the case of thinking. This refutes the opinion of Kant and Schopenhauer, and in a broader sense of Fichte also, that the laws we assume in order to explain the world are merely an effect of our own mental organization, and that we inject them into the world only because of our own mental individuality. Another objection might be raised from a subjective point of view. Even though the law-controlled relationship of the thought masses is not brought about according to our own organization, but depends upon the thought content, yet this very content may be a mere subjective product, a mere quality of our mind, so that we should merely be uniting elements produced first by ourselves. In this case, our thought world would be nonetheless a subjective appearance. But it is very easy to meet this objection. That is, if it were well founded, we should be uniting the content of our thoughts according to laws, while remaining wholly unaware as to whence these laws come. If these do not spring from our subjective being, a supposition we have already taken under consideration and set aside as untenable, what, then, could provide us with laws of interconnection for a content produced by ourselves? In other words, our thought world is an entity resting wholly upon itself, a totality self-enclosed, complete and entire within itself. Here we perceive which of the two aspects of the thought world is the essential one: the objective aspect of its content and not the subjective aspect of its mode of emergence. This insight into the inner purity and completeness of thought appears at its clearest in the scientific system of Hegel. No one else has attributed to thinking a power so complete that it could form a foundation in itself for a world conception. Hegel has absolute confidence in thinking. Indeed, it is the only factor of reality which he trusts in the fullest sense of the word. Yet although his point of view is in the main highly correct, he more than anyone else has destroyed confidence in thought by the excessively unqualified form in which he has applied it. The way in which he has presented his view is responsible for the irremediable confusion which has found its way into our, quote, thinking about thinking, unquote. He desires to make the importance of thought, of the idea, evident by defining rational necessity in the same terms as factual necessity. In doing so, he has given rise to the fallacy that thought determinations are not purely ideal, but factual. His point of view was soon so conceived as if he had sought for thought itself as one of the facts in the world of sensible reality. Indeed, he failed to make himself entirely clear in regard to this. The truth must be firmly grasped that the sphere of thought is in human consciousness alone. Then it must be shown that the thought world does not thereby sacrifice in the least its objectivity. Hegel exposed to view only the objective aspects of thought, but most persons see only what is easier to be seen, the subjective aspect, and it seems to them that Hegel treats something purely ideal as a thing, that is, that he indulged in a mystification. Even many scholars of the present time cannot be said to be quite free of this fallacy. They condemn Hegel because of the defect which he himself did not possess, but which can certainly be interjected into him because he failed to explain the matter in question with sufficient clearness. We admit that we are here faced by something which is difficult for us to judge with the capacities we possess. Yet we believe it can be mastered by every energetic thinker. We must form two different conceptions. First, that by our own activity we bring the ideal world to manifestation. And, secondly, at the same time, that what we by our activity call into existence rests nevertheless upon its own laws. Let me read that again. We must form two different conceptions. First, that by our own activity we bring the ideal world to manifestation, and secondly, at the same time, that what we by our activity call into existence rests nevertheless upon its own laws. It is true that we are accustomed so to conceive a phenomenon as if we needed only to stand passive before it, observing it. But this is not at all an absolute necessity. No matter how unfamiliar the conception may be to us, that we by our activity bring an objective entity to manifestation, that is, in other words, that we do not merely become aware of a phenomenon, but at the same time produce it, this conception is not at all invalid. It is only necessary that we should abandon the customary idea that there are as many thought worlds as there are human individuals. This idea is nothing more than an ancient preconception. It is tacitly presupposed everywhere without any consciousness that another conception is at least equally possible, and that the arguments for the validity of one or the other must therefore at least be weighed. Let us for a moment imagine, in place of the above preconception, the following: that there is one sole thought content, and that our individual thinking is nothing more than the act of working ourselves, our individual personalities, into the thought center of the world. This is not the place to investigate whether this point of view is correct or not, but it is possible, and we have attained what we wished to attain. That is, we have shown that it is entirely in order to postpone for the present undertaking to prove that the objectivity of thought, which we have declared to be a matter of necessity, is not a self-contradictory conception. From the point of view of its objectivity, the work of the thinker may very appropriately be compared with that of a mechanic. Just as the latter brings natural forces into reciprocal action and thus brings about a purposeful activity and exertion of forces, so the thinker causes thought elements to come into reciprocal activity, and these evolve into the thought systems which compose our sciences. There is no better means of throwing light upon a conception than by exposing the fallacies arrayed against it. Here again let us resort to this method, already profitably employed more than once. It is generally supposed that the reason why we unite certain concepts into greater complexes, or why we think at all in certain ways, is because we sense a certain inner, (logical) compulsion to do this. Foucault also has appropriated this opinion. But how can this be harmonized with the transparent clearness with which our whole thought world is present in consciousness? We know nothing in the world more thoroughly than we know our thoughts. Must we then assume a certain connection on the ground of an inner compulsion when everything is so clear? What need have I of the compulsion when I know the nature of what is to be united, know it through and through, and can guide myself according to this nature? All the operations of our thinking are processes which come to pass by reason of insight into the essential nature of the thoughts, and not according to compulsion. Such compulsion contradicts the nature of thinking. We might certainly admit the possibility that it may be a part of the essential nature of thinking to stamp its content directly upon its manifestation, but that nevertheless we cannot immediately perceive this content by means of our mental organization. But such is not the case. The way in which the thought content meets us is a guarantee to us that we here have the essential nature of the thing before us. We are assuredly aware that we accompany with our mind every process in the thought world. Yet we can only think that the form of manifestation of a thing is determined by its essential nature. How could we reproduce the form of appearance if we did not know the essential nature of the thing? It is possible to conceive that the form of appearance emerges before us as an existent whole, and we then seek for its central core. But it is impossible to maintain the point of view that we cooperate in producing the appearance without effecting this production by means of its own central core. Chapter 10. The Inner Nature of Thought. Let us draw one step nearer to thought. Hitherto, we have been considering the place of thought in relation to the rest of the world of experience. We have reached the conclusion that it holds a unique position in that world, that it plays a central role. We shall, for the present, turn our attention elsewhere. We shall here restrict ourselves to a consideration of the inner nature of thinking. We shall investigate the very character of the thought world itself, in order to perceive how one thought depends upon another, how thoughts are related to one another. From this inquiry we shall derive the means requisite for reaching a conclusion as to the question, quote, what is cognition in general, unquote? Or in other words, what is the meaning of forming thoughts about reality? What is the meaning of wishing to interpret the world by means of thinking? Here we must keep our minds free from any preconceived opinion. We should be holding such a preconception if we should assume that a concept, thought, is an image within our consciousness by means of which we reach a solution concerning an object existing outside of consciousness. Here we are not concerned with this and similar preconceptions. We take thoughts just as we find them. The question as to whether they sustain a relationship to anything else whatever, and if so, what sort of relationship, is just what we shall investigate. Therefore we must not posit such a relationship here as our point of departure. This very opinion concerning the relationship between concept and object is very widespread. Indeed, the concept is often defined as the mental counterpart of an object existing outside the mind. The concept is supposed to reproduce the object, mediating it to us, a true photograph of it. Let me read that again. The concept is supposed to reproduce the object, mediating to us a true photograph of it. Very often, when thinking is the subject of discussion, what people have in mind is only this preconceived relationship. Practically never does anyone consider the idea of traversing the realm of thoughts within their own sphere in order to discover what is to be found there. We will here investigate this realm just as if nothing whatever existed outside its boundaries, as if thought were the whole of reality. For a certain time, we shall turn our attention away from all the rest of the world. The fact that this sort of research has been neglected in those investigations concerning the theory of knowledge, which are based upon Kant, has been ruinous to this science. This omission has given an impulse to this science in a direction which is very opposite of our own. This scientific trend can never, by reason of its whole character, comprehend Goethe. It is, in the truest sense of the word, un-Goethean, to take as point of departure an assumption which is not found through observation, but actually injected into the thing it observed. But this is what actually occurs when one sets, at the very culmination of scientific knowledge, the preconception that the relation mentioned above does exist between thinking and reality, between the idea and the world. The only way to treat this matter, after the manner of Goethe, is to enter deeply into the nature of thinking itself, and then observe what relation comes about when thinking, thus known according to its own nature, is brought into relationship with experience. Goethe always takes the path of experience in the strictest sense. He first takes the objects as they are, and, while banishing entirely every subjective opinion, seeks to penetrate into their nature. He then creates the conditions under which the objects can appear in reciprocal action and watches to see the results. He seeks to give nature the opportunity to bring her laws into operation under especially characteristic circumstances, which he brings about, an opportunity, as it were, to express her own laws. How does our thinking appear to us when observed in itself? It is a multiplicity of thoughts, which are woven and bound organically together in the most complicated fashion. But when we have once penetrated this multiplicity from all directions, it becomes again a unity, a harmony. All the elements are related one to another. They exist for one another. One modifies another, restricts it, etc. The moment our mind conceives two corresponding thoughts, it observes at once that these really flow together to form a unit. It finds everywhere in its whole realm the interrelated. This concept unites with that. A third illuminates or supports a fourth, and so on. If, for example, we find in our consciousness the term organism, and we then scan our conceptual world, we meet with another concept, quote, systematic evolution, comma, growth, end quote. It becomes clear that these two concepts belong together, that they represent merely two aspects of one and the same thing. But this is true of our entire thought system. All individual thoughts are parts of a great whole, which we call our conceptual world. When any single thought emerges in consciousness, I cannot rest until this is brought into harmony with the rest of my thinking. Such an isolated concept, apart from the rest of my mental world, is entirely unendurable. I am simply conscious of the fact that there exists an inwardly sustained harmony among all thoughts, that the thought world is of the nature of a unit. Therefore, every such isolation is an abnormality, an untruth. When we have arrived at that state of mind in which our whole thought world bears the character of a complete inner harmony, we gain thereby the satisfaction for which our mind is striving. We feel that we are in possession of truth. Since we perceive truth in the thoroughgoing agreement of all concepts in our possession, the question at once forces itself upon us, quote, has thought, apart from all perceptible reality of the phenomenal world of the senses, a content of its own? When we have removed all sense content, is not the remainder an utter emptiness, a mere phantasm? End quote. It might well be a widespread opinion that this is true. Hence we must consider this opinion a little more closely. As we have already remarked above, it is very frequently assumed that the whole system of concepts is merely a photograph of the external world. It is firmly maintained that knowledge evolves in the form of thought, but it is demanded of, quote, strictly scientific knowledge, unquote, that it shall receive its content from without. According to this view, the world must provide the substance which flows into our concepts. Without that, these are mere empty forms, void of content. If the external world should vanish, then concepts and ideas would no longer have any meaning, for they exist by reason of that world. This point of view might be called the negation of the concept, for there it no longer possesses any significance in relation to objectivity. It is something added to the latter. The world would thus exist in all completeness, even were there no concepts whatever, for these contribute nothing new to the world. They contain nothing which would not be there without them. They are there only because the cognizing subject wills to use them in order to possess a form suitable to him what is otherwise already there. Let me read that again. They are there only because the cognizing subject wills to use them in order to possess in a form suitable to him what is otherwise already there. They are mere mediators to the subject of a content which is of a non-conceptual character. Such is the point of view under discussion. If it were well founded, one of the following assumptions would necessarily be true. Number one, that the conceptual world stands in such a relationship to the external world that it merely repeats the whole content of this in another form. Parenthesis, here the term external world means the sense world. Parenthesis. If such were the case, one could not perceive any necessity for lifting oneself at all above the sense world. In this latter, everything relating and pertaining to knowledge would already be given. Two, that the conceptual world takes as its content merely a part of the, quote, appearance for the senses, unquote. We may imagine the thing somewhat like this. We make a series of observations. We meet in these the most diverse objects. We discover in the process that certain characteristics which we observe in a certain object have already been observed by us. A series of objects pass in survey before our eyes, A, B, C, D, etc. Suppose A had the characteristics PQAR, B shows IMBN, C, KHCG, D, PUAV. Here, in the case of D, we meet again the characteristics of A and P previously observed in connection with A. We designate these characteristics as essential. And, insofar as A and D possess essential characteristics in common, we say they are of the same kind. Thus we unite A and D, in that we lay hold of their essential characteristics in our thinking. Here we have a thought which does not entirely coincide with the sense world, and to which the charge of superfluity mentioned above cannot be applied, and yet it is far from bringing anything new to the sense world. Against this we may say, first of all, that to determine which characteristics of a thing are essential requires to begin with a certain norm which will enable us to distinguish between essential and unessential. This norm cannot exist in the object itself, for this includes both the essential and the unessential in inseparable unity. This norm must belong to the very content of our thinking. But this objection does not wholly refute this point of view. One holding this view might meet the objection thus. He might admit that we have no justification for classifying any characteristic as essential or unessential, but might declare that this need not disturb us. that we simply classify things together when we observe similar characteristics in them, without any regard to the essential or unessential nature of these characteristics. This view, however, requires a presupposition which by no means squares with the facts. So long as we confine ourselves to sense experience, there is nothing really in common between two things of the same class. An example will make this clear. The simplest is the best because it can best be surveyed. He now has two triangles, triangle 1 and triangle 2, and they're kind of cattywampus from each other. Let us observe the two triangles above. What is there really in common between them when we confine ourselves to sense experience? Nothing whatever. That which they possess in common, that is, the principle on which they are formed and which causes them to be classed under the concept triangle, is attained only when we cross over the boundary of the sense experience. The concept triangle comprises all triangles. We do not attain to it by merely observing all individual triangles. This concept always remains the same, however frequently I may conceive it, whereas it will scarcely ever happen that I shall see two identical triangles. That, by reason of which a single triangle is this triangle and no other, has nothing to do with the concept. A specific triangle is this specific one, not because it corresponds to the concept, but because of elements which lie entirely outside the concept, the length of its sides, the measurements of its angles, its position, etc. Yet it is quite incorrect to maintain that the content of the concept is borrowed from the external sense world, since it is evident that its content is not to be found in any sense phenomenon. Let me read that last sentence again. Yet it is quite incorrect to maintain that the content of the concept is borrowed from the external sense world, since it is evident that its content is not to be found in any sense phenomenon. 3. Still a third view is possible. The concept may be the mediator through which two apprehend certain entities which are not perceptible to the senses, but which possess a self-sustaining character. This character would be the non-conceptual content of the conceptual form of our thought. Whoever assumes such entities existing beyond the boundaries of experience and attributes to us the possibility of a knowledge of these entities must necessarily see in the concept the interpreter of this cognition. The inadequacy of this point of view we shall later make especially clear. For the moment we need only remark that in any case it does not run counter to the contentual character of the conceptual world. Let me read that again. The contentual is C-O-N-T-E-N-T, contentual, contentual, maybe, contentual. I'll read the sentence again. For the moment we need only remark that in any case it does not run counter to the contentual character of the conceptual world. For if the object about which we think really lay beyond the boundaries of experience and of thinking, thought would all the more have to contain within itself the content upon which it rests. It could still not think about objects of which no trace could be found within the thought world. In any case, it is clear that thought is no empty vessel, but that in and of itself it is possessed of content, and that its content does not square with that of any other form of phenomenon. Part D. Knowledge. Chapter 11. Thought and Perception. Knowledge permeates perceived reality with the concepts apprehended and worked through by our thinking. It supplements and deepens that which is passively received by means of what our mind, through its own activity, has lifted out of the darkness of the merely potential into the light of reality. This presupposes that perception needs to be supplemented by the mind, that perception is not in itself something definitive, final, conclusive. The fundamental fallacy of modern science consists in the fact that it looks upon sense perception as something conclusive, complete. For this reason, it sets itself the task simply to photograph this existence, complete in itself. The only view which is logical in this respect is positivism, which simply rejects every advance beyond perception. Yet one observes nowadays, in almost all branches of science, an endeavor to look upon this world, to look upon this point of view. Let me read that sentence again. Yet one observes nowadays, in almost all branches of science, an endeavor to look upon this point of view as being correct. In the true sense of the word, such a demand would be adequate only for such a science as merely enumerates and describes things as they exist beside one another in space, and occurrences as they follow one another in time. Natural history of the older type comes closest to meeting this requirement. This newer type makes the same demand, to be sure, and sets forth a complete theory of experience, only, however, to transgress this at once the moment it undertakes the first step into real knowledge. If we should wish to lay hold upon pure experience, we should have to empty ourselves completely of our thinking. To deny to thinking the capacity for perceiving in itself entities which are inaccessible to the senses is a degradation of thought. Apart from the factor of sensible qualities, there must be within reality a factor which is apprehended by thought. Thinking is an organ of man ordained to observe something higher than is afforded by the senses. To thinking is accessible that side of reality of which a mere sense being could never become aware. What thought exists for is not merely to repeat the sensible, but to penetrate into what is concealed from the senses. The sense percept gives us only one side of reality. The other side is the apprehending of the world through thinking. At first appearance, thought seems to us something quite alien to perception, for perception enters into us from without, while thinking works from within outward. The content of thought appears to us as an inwardly complete organism. All is in the closest interrelationship. The individual members of the thought system mutually determine one another. Each single concept has its ultimate roots in the totality of our thought structure. At first glance, it seems as if the inner freedom from contradiction, which characterizes thought, its self-sufficiency, rendered any transition to the percept an impossibility. Were the thought characterizations such that they could be satisfied in one way alone, thinking would really be confined within itself. Were the thought characterizations such that they could be satisfied in one way alone, thinking would really be confined within itself. We could not emerge from within it. But this is not the case. These characterizations are such that they may be satisfied in a variety of different ways. Only the element which produces this multifariousness must not be sought within thinking itself. Let us take the thought characterization, quote, "the earth attracts every other body," unquote. We shall observe at once that the thought admits of the possibility of being fulfilled in the most diverse ways. But these are variations which can no longer be reached by thinking. There is room for another element. This element is the sense percept. This percept affords such a form of specialization of thought characterizations which is left open by thought itself. It is in this specialization that the world meets us when we make use of mere experience. Psychologically, that comes first, which in point of fact is the derivative. In all working over of reality through cognition, the process is as follows. We meet with a concrete percept. It confronts us as a riddle. Within us, the impulse manifests itself to investigate its what? Its real nature, which the percept itself does not express. This impulse is nothing but the upward working of a concept out of the darkness of our consciousness. We then hold this concept firmly while the sense percept moves on a parallel line with this thought process. The mute percept suddenly speaks a language intelligible to us. We know that the concept which we have taken hold of is that real nature of the percept for which we have been seeking. What has here come about is a judgment. It is different from that form of judgment which unites two concepts without reference to percepts. When I say, quote, freedom is the determination of a being from within itself, unquote, I have here also formed a judgment. The constituents of this judgment are concepts not given to me in perception. Upon such judgments rest that inner unity of our thought which we discussed in the preceding chapter. The judgment which we now consider has for its subject a percept, and for predicate a concept. Quote, this animal before me is a dog, unquote. In such a judgment, a percept is injected into my thought system at a determinate place. Let us call such a judgment a perceptual judgment. By means of the perceptual judgment, we cognize that a determinate, sensible object corresponds by nature with a determinate concept. If then we are to comprehend what we perceive, the percept must have been formed within us beforehand as a determinate concept. Any object of which this were not true, we should pass by without its being intelligible to us. That such is the case is best shown by the fact that persons who have lived a rich mental life also penetrate far deeper into the world of experiences than do others of whom this is not true. Much that passes over others without leaving a trace makes a deep impression upon these persons. Quote, if the eye were not sunlike, it could never see the sun. Unquote. But it may be asked, do we not meet in our lives innumerable things of which we have not previously had the slightest conception? And do we not on the spot form concepts of these? Undoubtedly. But is the sum of all potential concepts identical with the sum of those which I have already formed in the previous part of my life? Is not my conceptual system capable of evolving? In the presence of a reality which is unintelligible to me, can I not set my thinking in action in order that it may evolve on the spot the concept which I must match? Let me read that again. In the presence of a reality which is unintelligible to me, can I not set my thinking in action in order that it may evolve on the spot the concept with which I must match the object? I need only possess the capacity of drawing a determinate concept out of the store of the thought world. It is not that a determinate concept was already consciously known to me in the previous part of my life, but that this concept can be drawn forth from the world of thoughts accessible to me. Where and when I grasp the concept is not essential to its content. Indeed, I bring forth thought characterizations out of the thought world. Nothing whatever flows from the sensible object into this content. I simply recognize in the sensible object the thought which I draw forth from within myself. This object induces me to be sure to call forth at a certain moment from the unity of all potential thoughts just this one thought content. But it does not by any means furnish me the material for constructing the thought. This I must draw from within myself. When we cause our thinking to become active, only then does reality attain to true characterizations. Previously mute, it now speaks a clear language. Our thinking is the interpreter that explains the dumb show of experience. Men are so accustomed to look upon the world of concepts as void of content, and to contrast with this world the percept as being filled with content and thoroughly determinate, that it will be difficult for the true facts of the case to win the place belonging to them. The truth is entirely overlooked, that mere beholding is the emptiest thing imaginable, and that it receives content only from thinking. The sole truth in regard to the object is that it holds the constant flux of thought in a determinate form without our having to cooperate actively in thus holding it. When one who has a rich mental life sees 1,000 things which are nothing to the mentally poor, this shows as clearly as sunlight that the content of reality is only the reflection of the content of our minds, and that we receive from without merely the empty form. Of course, we must possess the inner power to recognize ourselves as the creator of this content. Otherwise, we shall forever see only the reflection and never our own mind, which is reflected. Indeed, one who perceives himself in an actual mirror must know himself as a personality in order to recognize himself in the reflected image. All sense perception finally resolves itself, as to its essential nature, into ideal content. Only then does it appear to us transparent and clear. The sciences are to a large extent wholly unaffected by the consciousness of this truth. Thought characterizations are considered the attributes of objects, like colors, odors, etc. Thus it is supposed that all bodies are characterized by the definition that they remain in the state wherein they are, of rest or motion, until an influence from without alters their state. It is in this form that the law of inertia plays its role in natural science. But the actual fact is something quite different. In my conceptual system, the concept body exists in many modifications. One of these is the concept of a thing which can of itself set itself in motion or come to rest. Another is the concept of a body which alters its state only under an external influence. These latter bodies we designate as inorganic. If then I meet a certain body which reflects in the percept the above conceptual definition, I designate it as inorganic, and unite with it all characterizations which follow from the concept of an inorganic body. All sciences should be permeated by the conviction that their content is solely a thought content, and that they sustain no other relationship to perception than that they see in the perceptual object a specialized form of the concept. It's the end of this section, and that was the end of chapter 11 in its